I'm Chris Kraft, and for the people out there in the Netherlands, this talk is about soils as an integrator of wetland structure and function following restoration. And I would like to thank Lee for providing us with this sweet spot. You know, Monday morning, leadoff hitter. You can't ask for better time, I don't think, to give a talk. So anyway, I'm going to take you back in time, and I apologize to Mike Bepraskis, who's seen some of these slides before, but you know, wetland creation and restoration is not an entirely new phenomena, and some of the earliest experimental type studies go back to the 1960s. Again, funded by Jacob's employee, the Army Corps of Engineers, who are interested in things like stabilizing dredge material to reduce dredging cost. And the goal of this was to take a fresh dredge spoil island like this and establish, in this case, tidal marsh vegetation on it. And, you know, these were studies in the late 1960s, and these were really some of the earliest experimental studies to investigate the environmental requirements of different plant species, their hydrologic requirements, their nutrient requirements, and also, in these cases, the optimum salinities that they would grow at. And the people who did this were at North Carolina State University, Dr. W.W. Woodhouse, Steve Broom, who's still there, and Ernie Seneca. And they did a good job. Not only did they learn about, you know, how to establish and what to establish on these dredge spoil islands, but they did some of the first experimental work to assess structure and function. Do these man-made systems provide the same level of services? In this case, they're out there measuring above-ground biomass to see if they provide the same levels as a nearby natural tidal marsh. And the sites have persisted over time. The last time I visited this site was 1998, and you know, that's 16 years ago, but at that time the site was 28 years old, and it persisted through a number of hurricanes, and my guess is these sites are still there today. So with the success, and this work started in North Carolina, but the Corps funded similar studies in Galveston Bay, in South Carolina, and in the Chesapeake Bay. But the Corps got interested in the 1970s in using these sort of techniques to stabilize eroding shorelines, such as this site here. And again, pioneering work was done here. I think we understood at this point what species do you plant, and you need to add a little bit of nitrogen to them at the time that you plant them to jumpstart the community. But work here was done to kind of identify what is the optimum spacing that you put these plants in the ground. If you plant closely together, you'll get good coverage very quickly, but it costs more money. So they determined that kind of ideal spacings in terms of getting good coverage but also being cost effective were about on meter, 1 meter intervals. So again, we fast forward to the end of the last century. This particular site now is 24 years old. North Carolina had a series of hurricanes in the 1990s. It took out a lot of docks and boat ramps, but these sites persist. But as an ecologist, that doesn't surprise us too much because these natural systems have evolved under these types of periodic storm conditions. Well, we moved to the 1980s, and we've had several amendments to the Clean Water Act now, and wetlands are considered, at least many of them, are considered waters of the United States and enjoy protection at the federal level. And this is where mitigation really took off. The idea is that you had to, if you caused unavoidable damage to wetlands or other aquatic systems, you had to replace the resource. And, of course, developers love this kind of idea because, you know, they want to build marinas and things on the water that have high real estate value, and they can go build a wetland offsite or somewhere else. And some of these mitigation projects like this one, it was taking an upland site and grading it down to intertidal elevations. And you can see you've got terrestrial soil characteristics there just by the evidence of all the oxidized iron. And the scale of the projects got bigger. We got a little bit smarter about putting in tidal creeks, like you see here, although we're still not that smart because they're linear, and if you go and look at how nature does it, nature tends to put curves in them. But we encountered some unforeseen problems here, things like exposure of acid sulfate soils like jarosite. And this occurred in spots, not over the entire area, but then you you know, you expose this to air and the pH drops to 2 and your plants don't grow. And you have to come in and add considerable amount of lime to these areas to neutralize that acidity and bring the pH up to 4 to 4.5 to where you can get established vegetation. And this was a brackish water marsh, so the salinity was not quite so high. And here we experimented with a number of different species. So we're starting to try to incorporate species diversity in addition to wetland functions into these mitigation projects. This is a site about 5 or 6 years later, and this particular site was a focus of a number of studies of finfish and bird utilization of the wetlands. Not only just soil properties and plant establishment, but looking and seeing whether the fauna component is there. I got to visit this site in the not-too-distant past in 2008, and at this point it's 25 years old, and you can see that at least on the surface, that's a pretty healthy-looking marsh. And then, you know, in the 1990s and into this century, with the passage of the Conservation Reserve Program and the Wetland Reserve Program, there was a lot of interest in creating and restoring freshwater wetlands, particularly marshes, but also bottomland forests, on former agricultural land. And this is a site up in northwest Indiana, not too far from Chicagoland, where the land was enrolled in a WRP program, taken out of production, and you basically either plug the ditches or you fill the ditches and restore hydrology, and you may plant or seed, or you may just let the plants colonize naturally. But this is that same site 10 years later in 2011, a species-rich freshwater marsh. Well, I've talked a lot about wetlands and about vegetation, but I haven't talked much about soils yet. You know, when you walk out onto a site, the plants are the most conspicuous feature, and that's why things like the hydrogeomorphic approach and these rapid assessment approaches focus so much on vegetation. I think I'm speaking to a room of mostly soil scientists, and so we know that we have to dig beneath the surface to look at some of these soil-based properties. Let me back up a minute, but what I want to do is talk about the role of soils and wet restoration from a characterizing hydrology of sites, their support of heterotrophic food webs, and to touch a little bit on what Jacob talked about is some of the functions, but particularly related to biogeochemical or nutrient cycling functions. Well, from a hydrologic perspective, and there are people in this room who know a whole lot more about this than I do, but, you know, soils are a great integrator of antecedent hydrologic conditions. And if you look at a core like this, it's nice and glade, it's a mineral soil, highly reduced, but that can tell us that this soil is wet most all year. It's a waterlogged soil, and it's indicative of this near continuous inundation, pretty much 9 to 12 months out of the year. But you take you go to another site and sample soils, and you get something like this. You still have a reduced matrix, but you see a lot more oxidized iron in it, and this is more indicative of something like a fluctuating water table that occurs during the year. And this particular core was taken from the Altamaha River floodplain in southeast Georgia, and this is about a 10-year hydrologic record, and you can see every year we get the late winter, early spring flood pulse. And some years that flood pulse is kind of muted, and then in other years it's a pretty dramatic. But you notice in every year there's a summer to fall dry down period of anywhere from 5 to 7 months. And these are the type of hydrologic soil-based indicators that we would see. And then, of course, kind of the extreme cases of soil saturation are where you get something like peat forming, peat accretion. And in these sites, you don't necessarily have standing water, but this is indicative of year-round soil saturation. These are, the most interesting of wetland soils because they're driven by biologic processes. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about soils and restored and created wetlands. These are a couple of cores from a mitigation marsh, and this particular core was taken low by the creek. So this is lower in elevation, and it's flooded longer. You can see it's nice and glade. You are seeing a bit of organic matter enrichment in the surface layer. This core was taken up closer to the upland edge. It's higher up in elevation. It's not flooded as long. And while there is some evidence of reduction going on, you still see some indicators of terrestrial soil conditions. This is the reference marsh. This is the marsh that they destroyed, or they were going to destroy, and to replace it with these particular soils here. And you can see that when you try to build peat, in this case, that's going to take quite a bit of time. All right, and soil development does take time. It's not something, at least in terms of these bulk properties, that you're going to see over a period of months. This is a core from that dredge spoil island, and this is 20 years after the site was planted. And the initial planting substrate was this coarse reduced sand here, and in a 20-year period, we've got about 10 centimeters of organic-rich surface soil starting to develop. And we can look at bulk soil properties in these types of cores and in different aged mitigation or restored and created wetlands. And what I'm looking at here is just percent organic carbon in two depths, the surface 10 centimeters and in the 10 to 30 centimeters. And these points here on the bottom, they represent a chronosequence of eight different aged created tidal marshes. They're all flooded. They all have the same hydrology, flooded twice daily by the astronomical tides. All planted with, can you hold the question until I get done? They're all planted with Spartina alterniflora, and they all have comparable salinities. And you can see certainly that surface soil development in terms of organic matter enrichment occurs a lot faster than does the surface soil. Not surprisingly, because the organic matter in the roots are mostly in the top 10 centimeters. We look at bulk density in these same cores at these same sites. And of course, as you add organic matter and plant roots develop, bulk density decreases, and that decreases a lot more rapid in surface soils than in subsurface soils. And my battery is dying on me on this pointer, but that's okay. All right, we also look at nitrogen. And this is important more for the plant community, because typically these systems are, the plants are nitrogen limited. And so you want to build up some nitrogen capital, and that occurs as you add organic matter. And that is mostly occurring in the 0 to 10 centimeters, but there is a little bit of enrichment in the 10 to 30 centimeter depth as well. And our chronosequence represents sites that range from 1 year old to 28 years old. Pretty nice mixture. All right, you know, a lot of people, especially ecologists, are interested in, well, these things are great, but are they providing food web support? And we can look at some things. The base of the food web are not the charismatic birds, and they're not the finfish, but they're the microorganisms, and they're the benthic invertebrates, the worms that the birds and the finfish feed on. And these graphs are a little bit different. I'm plotting organic carbon here on the x-axis and microbial decomposition measured by CO2 fluxes from incubated cores on the y. And we've removed the roots from the cores to get rid of the root contribution to CO2 evolution. And there are 16 marshes plotted on here. There are eight chronosequence constructed marshes, but there are also eight natural reference marshes. These reference marshes are old. They're several hundred years to several thousand years. But they're the ones that get destroyed, and when we create a restore marsh, that's what we're trying to replace. And what I want to illustrate in this particular graph is, as you increase organic carbon content up to about 8% at least, there's this linear increase in microbial decomposition. It's not surprising. The more organic matter you have, the more food there is for the microbes. We looked at methane production in these, and we see a similar pattern, although there's more scatter in the data. But again, more carbon is better, and it's a linear function. And then last but not least, we look at denitrification. And this, of course, is important from a water quality improvement standpoint. But again, the more you have, although there is more scatter in the data set, at least up to about 8% carbon, the more potential denitrification you'll see. Well, the microbes are providing some food, not so much for the fish, but for these benthic invertebrates. These are oligochaete and polychaete worms, the chironomid larvae in freshwater wetlands, and this is the base of these food webs, of most all wetlands, maybe not peatlands. Well, they show a different trajectory with carbon content. It's more of this asymptotic rise to max. And at first, you have very low densities. And these numbers, this is 100,000 per meter squared in the top 5 centimeters of soil. These things are small, but they're very numerous. But it looks to me like they need some sort of threshold or minimum carbon content. That once you get up to about 2% organic carbon, 4% organic matter, you develop at least numerically comparable densities of these critters. This is diversity. This is number of taxa that we identified. We did not go to species because it's pretty difficult. But again, there seems to be this sort of threshold that you need a certain amount of organic carbon to get this food web going, but more is not necessarily better. You need about 2%. All right, and then last but not least, let's talk a little bit about nutrient cycling. Two wetland soil cores, mineral soil, nice and glade. This is from a mitigation marsh. This is the reference marsh. There's 2 meters of peat here. We dated the basal organic matter, the basal layer, at about 2,400 years ago. So the peat started to accumulate about 2,000 to 2,500 years ago. We want this core to eventually look like this one. We're seeing a little bit of evidence at the top, but it's going to take some time. Well, we know, I think everybody in the room, that relative to terrestrial soils, wetlands sequester carbon at higher rates. And this is true for non-tidal wetlands, everything from bogs to floodplains, but also tidal wetlands do it as well. The difference between northern and southern bogs is the southern bogs, and this is like Okefenokee Swamp, things like that, they're exposed to wildfire. And so carbon doesn't build up as fast because those surface soils burn periodically. And Lee's waving me into the home stretch, which is good because I'm almost done. Well, these created and restored wetlands also sequester carbon. This is back to my chronosequence again, not all the sites. And there is site-to-site variability, but if you look at the mean values of natural reference marshes and constructed marshes, these constructed marshes are sequestering carbon at comparable rates, about 45 grams per meter squared per year. We go to our freshwater marshes in Indiana, and we look at things like our 10-year-old freshwater marshes and reference marshes in the area. And we also sampled some planted 5-year-old riparian forests. And in terms of denitrification, and we measure ambient and potential, our restored wetlands are really not performing at the same level as our natural wetlands are. They're relatively low in carbon compared to these. The interesting thing we found is that our 5-year-old restored riparian forest, you know, the trees are only about 10 feet tall, denitrify at comparable rates to a nice mature forest. But both of these sites are receiving overbank flooding of river water that's high in nitrate, and so the microbial communities are there to support denitrification. And I guess there's adequate carbon in these soils to support it as well. And then we also looked at phosphorus sorption, again in these 10-year-old these WRP marshes and some 5-year-old CRP riparian forests. We see this similar pattern. You know, the restored wetlands are really not sorbing that much phosphorus compared to the natural wetlands. These have the highest rates of peat sorption. But our riparian forest, our 5-year-old sites, are sorbing phosphorus at comparable amounts to what we see in a 40-year-old riparian forest. And the phosphorus sorption and the denitrification, we think, too, is linked to increasing organic matter content. And this is the natural wetland here. It has higher organic carbon, has much higher phosphorus sorption index. And this is a restored wetland right here, lower carbon levels and lower phosphorus sorption. And so to conclude in my last 45 seconds, soil properties, at least the bulk properties, do change slowly over time, and you really need to follow them over a period of years to decades. The change, of course, is going to be faster in the surface layers than in the subsurface layers, and that's important for the biota because most of that food web is concentrated in the top 5 to 10 centimeters. These heterotrophic food webs are linked to increasing soil organic matter, and the nutrient cycling processes like denitrification and phosphorus sorption are as well. And so my take-home message is when it does come to wetland restoration, it is about soil, but it's specifically it's about soil organic matter. Thank you.
Thank you.